Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. It's usually wise to enter a war zone armed with more than just a camera. War photography may be the most dangerous job in journalism, yet without it, the public would completely be blind to the struggles and hopes of soldiers fighting overseas and the people stuck in the middle of conflict. With us today are two brave souls who have done extensive coverage of the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and beyond. Lindsay Addario is author of It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. She's covered conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, and the Congo. Her work appears in the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine. She's the winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant and the Pulitzer Prize. She joins us this morning via Skype from London. Lindsay, good morning. Nice to have you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Ashley Gilbertson is also with us. He speaks at the Nelson Atkins Auditorium at 6 o'clock Thursday evening to present the photo series Bedrooms of the Fallen, which examines the bedrooms of fallen soldiers. He's won a National Magazine Award for that series, which ran in the New York Times Magazine. He also wrote Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, A Photographer's Chronicle of the Iraq War. And Ashley, it's nice to have you too. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Lindsay, let me start with you. My first question for both of you is, how on earth did each of you wind up as a war photographer?
Oh, well, first of all, hi, Ash.
hi, Lindsay.
You're buddies, eh?
Yeah, we are, actually. I never set out to be a war photographer. I sort of started covering life overseas and was working in Argentina, and then eventually moved to India. And there I started covering life under the Taliban in Afghanistan. Mm. And that was sort of my first experience working in a country that would be considered a conflict zone, even though there was not active combat going on. And then from there, I ended up covering the fall of the Taliban in Kandahar in 2001 after September 11th. And it became very clear to me soon after that, soon after the attacks of September 11th, that we were about to embark as a nation into a long journey of war.
And did you take to war coverage pretty quickly, Lindsay, or how did it go for you?
No, I mean, I was terrified the first time I was shot at, the first time a car exploded near me. Yeah. I mean, I was not, I certainly was not sort of going into these situations revved up for war. I was very tentative, but I did know that I really wanted to cover the human cost and the humanitarian issues that surround war. So I was very driven to cover those things, but never really, and to this day, after almost 15 years of working in war zones, I still get nervous every time I go into a war zone. Hmm.
Ashley, how did you wind up as a war photographer?
I think like Lindsay, I didn't intend to become, you know, like this frontline person. However, you know, I certainly set out with looking at humanitarian issues as like a main sort of theme of my photography. I think like America, where I grew up, it was a very, very racist country, in Australia. So, you know, having that racism around me growing up, I think for whatever reason, being a little bit more, open-minded as a kid, I reacted very strongly against it. So my role as a photographer was very much to try to humanize the other, you know, the foreigner, the scary foreigner that was apparently threatening out their shores in Australia. So that led me, you know, around the world to Kosovo and Afghanistan and Indonesia and the Philippines. And part of that was covering conflict. But, you know, I was very much focused on the edges of it. But it wasn't until 2002 when I went to Iraq and to Kurdistan, actually, up north. And I really sort of fell in love with the story and the people up there. But in 2003, when Colin Powell went to the UN and, you know, pretty much stated a case for war against Iraq, I felt a very strong compulsion to go back to Iraq and photograph the invasion. I mean, I didn't know what a no-name Australian photographer could do to help, but I thought that anything I could do would be better than nothing. And it was during that time that, you know, I started to see guys, you know, point guns at each other and try to kill each other. And I really, that shocked me and, like, put the fear of God in me. But it also fascinated me as to how we could possibly do that and how we could bring ourselves to try to kill each other and inflict this pain on each other and knowingly inflicting pain on civilians caught in the middle. And, you know, quite honestly, two books and many years later, I still have no idea.
And Ashley, your mom and dad said what about you doing this?
Oh, man. Really? Look, this is a really difficult part of our jobs, I think. And I think that when we're younger, I'd be interested to hear what Lindsay has to say about this, but I know that when I was younger, I made an active effort to ignore how my family felt about what I was doing. It was so hard. It was virtually impossible to get on a plane and go to Iraq and to, you know, some of the most dangerous places in the world, and other countries, you know, and really be empathetic with my family. So I would, my personal sort of way to deal with that was to ignore it. They were very, very unhappy, though, as any parent would. I mean, I've got a child of my own now, and one of my greatest fears that he would grow up admiring what I do and wanting to do it himself.
Yeah.
Lindsay, did you ignore it with your family, too?
I didn't ignore it, but I had the good fortune of having parents who did not read the newspaper at that time. So they were not really aware of what was going on until I had already really started covering conflict. So, in fact, the first time I went to Afghanistan when it was under the Taliban, I remember I called my mother the night before I left and I said, "Mom, I'm going to Afghanistan tomorrow." And she said, "Okay, honey, have a good time." You know, she had no idea. And most people didn't because it was before September 11th, you know. So I think really at that time it didn't, you know, it wasn't on people's radar. And then after that, when I realized, okay, this is something that I'm probably going to do pretty consistently, and I was working in Iraq, I spared my parents the details of when I thought something was dangerous until after I came out. So and that became a pattern for how I continued working. And I still do that now, where if I think I'm going into a really dangerous situation, I will have a conversation with my husband, we'll talk it through. But I often, when I'm in the throes of that assignment, I don't call because my voice often betrays how nervous I am. And so I would rather not worry my loved ones until I'm out.
And so the question becomes, Lindsay, why you do what you do. And I obviously was struck by the title of your book, which again is, "It's What I Do." And as Jon Stewart of The Daily Show said to you not too long ago, the title seems like it's your very direct answer to the question you get asked all the time, which is, you do this why, girl?
Well, that is exactly why I titled the book that, because I don't have a better answer. I mean, everyone says, why would you possibly do this for a living? Why would you subject yourself to these dangers? And for me, it is what I do, and it is who I am, and it has become so much a part of my life that it is not, you know, I'm so invested in this life that I couldn't suddenly wake up and become a different person with different values and walk away from everything that I believe in. And so, you know, I think it is a constant negotiation for me and for my family to try and figure out how to continue doing the stories I believe in and stay alive. But at the same time, I don't think I could ever know what's going on around me and just turn a blind eye.
Well, help me with that. The stories that you believe in, you mean what by that?
I mean that there are stories where I feel my coverage can make a difference. They can enlighten people. They can educate people. They can move them to action. They can create a document of history. They can make policymakers have to respond to something. So I think, you know, we often see the power of photography. We often see how an image can compel someone to react and to move and to do something.
You know, Lindsay, you write in your book, and I just love this line, that many times the question for you isn't about whether you should go into a dangerous situation. The question is, why couldn't you be in two dangerous situations at the same time? You feel that committed to what you do.
I mean, it's not necessarily about being in a dangerous situation. It's about being on different stories. And so, you know, I think for me, for example, last week I was in Sicily covering the migrant shipwreck. So I was covering migrants showing up to Sicily's shores. And that's something that I worked on for the better part of last fall. And sometimes I feel I can effectively do that work and sometimes I can't. Like, for example, there were so many journalists last week, it was very hard to get anything different. But I feel like when I'm there, I also feel like, well, maybe I should be covering Yemen, or maybe I should be covering people fleeing Yemen, because that's also a situation where there's a massive humanitarian crisis. And now I'm sitting at home editing pictures from India from 2 weeks ago, watching the earthquake in Nepal. Mm-hmm. So I'm constantly feeling like I'm not doing enough.
Ashley, you know, I'm just guessing, and tell me if I'm presupposing too much here, that your feelings for doing what you do match Lindsay's in many ways. And I'm wondering to what extent you find yourself frustrated from time to time at the relative, I'm speaking broadly here, the relative lack of interest in this country at things that go on outside of our borders, these tremendous humanitarian crises. Do you struggle with that?
I struggle with it, except, and I think that that's limited to the United States. You know, we have the same problem in Australia, and I live here now, so it's very much, you know, my adopted country. But, you know, we're living in Europe, living in Australia, living in the U.S., like, I'm constantly frustrated that people aren't as engaged as, you know, those of us in the news covering these issues are. Like, I wish everybody was like Lindsay. I think that the world would have far fewer problems. I know that that's the case.
And,
you know, I feel like it's our job as photographers to, you know, like, this is very much our calling, but this is very much our purpose as well. And in the sense that, you know, by trying to ignite some sort of interest, then we will draw more people into the story. However, I think that there's a big question of responsibility in this. And, you know, I look at stories that are taking place around the world. I mean, for example, if I get on a plane today and I go, like, let's say I fly to Yemen, or let's say I fly to, you know, a Syrian refugee camp at the Turkish border. Now, if I go there and I shoot pictures that look like, you know, the Associated Press pictures or Reuters pictures, and I haven't got the sort of research and contact and knowledge and depth of the story, you know, then what am I really contributing? You know, do I expect American or European readers to react differently to my photographs because I took them, you know, versus a Reuters or AP picture that's already out there? No, I don't think that they can. I think that what's really important and what I love about, you know, the variety of photographers and their different approaches that are out there today is that there are completely different approaches to the same story. I mean, you look at Ukraine and Maiden Square, and, you know, we had photographers out there that were shooting, you know, there was like full-on portrait studios out in the front line, so people covering the news, which is, you know, the breaking news, which was vitally important. We had a photographer who was doing details of Molotov cocktails. I mean, there was the most amazing work coming out of there and different ways to engage in the same story. And that's really important.
Well, how do you decide then, you know, Ashley, how you want to engage in a certain story and present something that's a little bit different? How do you approach that?
Well, I think it's both content-driven and subject-driven. I mean, for content, you know, I spent many years working in Iraq, except then I spent almost as many years working with veteran issues in the United States. And in that, I felt that most of my work miserably failed. You know, I was photographing stories about people who had killed themselves. I was photographing people who had post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury, depression, you know, mostly as a result of their experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, you know, those pictures would be pictures of people sitting around looking sad or drinking too much, whatever it was. And while it didn't really translate into a really moving story. So I was sitting with my wife one day reading the paper. And the New York Times used to publish every 1,000 deaths, they would publish a double-page spread of all of the 1,000 faces. Hmm. And my wife turned to me and said, you need to photograph their bedroom. And it was the most compassionate and perfect way to actually express who these people were outside of the uniforms. Because at that point, you know, we had read 3,000 obituaries of men and women who had died overseas. And the obits started feeling like a template. You know, he loved Friday night football and Monday night with his friends at Red Lobster. It was the same thing over and over again. But the bedrooms, we could actually connect to who they were. But then there's content of stories. You know, there's places that are so hard to get to that, you know, it's important just to go there and then document it. You know, and in my case, that was like the South China Sea 18 months ago. No academic, no photographer, no reporter had ever been out there. So just going out there and creating a reportage, I felt like was enough because it was such a bizarre place.
Hey, Ashley, just walk with me one more step here. Photographing bedrooms connects with people. Why? And I hope you hugged and kissed your wife at what a tremendously great idea she had about shooting bedrooms. Really. I mean, what an idea. Yeah. But why is that effective in your view?
It's effective because we can all relate. You know, it's something that we can all relate to. I think it's very, very difficult to relate, you know, for a New Yorker to relate to Red Lobster or for anybody to relate to what it's like in a place like Iraq or Afghanistan. You know, why the politics get dropped out of the question. You know, the foreignness of the country in which these men and women died gets dropped out of the question. And all of a sudden, you realize that these are, you know, human beings, and like they're sons and daughters just like we have. I mean, mm-hmm. I know when I was taking these pictures, it took 7 years to shoot the book, and it came out last year. And in during that time, I had my own child. You know, and as the book came to a close, he had started decorating his, like, you know, putting stuff into his room, like stuff mm-hmm. that he loved, whether it was like his, like, rock collection or his toys. And coming home from these trips, I'd like walk into his room and start crying because I could imagine losing my own kids. So the book, you know, and then that room being there mm-hmm. and wondering myself what to do with it. I mean, these families, and I think we can all imagine, you know, like there was the family of Jack Sweet, who was from the Thousand Island region of upstate New York. And I went to visit his father and I went into his room and I said, you know, his dirty laundry is still there. And his dad said, yeah. When he comes home, he can wash that his damn self. And I started laughing with him. I called him back a couple of years later and said, you know, is the dirty laundry still there? And he said, yeah, but my son's not coming home, and it's the only thing that still smells like him.
Mm-hmm. I should Ashley will be presenting the photo series Bedrooms of the Fallen at 6 o'clock Thursday evening at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Go to the website for more information about that. It'll be a very moving presentation because these photographs, I guarantee you, are very moving. I've seen a whole bunch of them here. And again, we're visiting this morning with a pair of wartime photographers, Lindsay Addario, a Pulitzer Prize winner, Ashley Gilbertson, both highly decorated for the work that they do. You know, Lindsay, I'm wondering, I think people get the impression sometimes that when you guys work overseas, that you have an American GI heavily armed standing over your right shoulder, make, you know, keeping you safe and protected from all the evils of the world. Set people straight. How much protection do you have when you're working overseas?
I'd say about 90% of the time I have no protection. Yeah. I have the protection of my driver and translator who are often locals from wherever I'm working. And I tend to go around as low profile as I can in the sense that if I'm working in Afghanistan, I'll dress much like the Afghan women do, or I'll just try to blend in as much as I can. And as a woman, I think I have a great advantage in being able to do that because I can wear a headscarf, wear longer clothes, dress, blend in much more easily. But I don't have an American GI standing next to me if I'm embedded with the troops. Certainly, I have the protection of the soldiers if we're on patrols. And for many years, I did many embeds with the American troops in Afghanistan and Iraq and did enjoy their protection as we were going out into really hostile areas. But a lot of the work I do is just with the civilians.
I should just point out to our listeners that we have photo samples from each of our photographers on our website, kcur.org. Just click on our show up to date. You can go look at these terrific photographs. And one more thing, Lindsay, I mean, to what extent does the news organization you're working for, do they look after what you're doing?
So I am very selective about who I will actually work for because I want to make sure that if something happens to me, and it certainly has, that they will have my back and that they will look after me. And I think that there are, at this time of budgets being very slim, there are few publications that actually do look after their freelancers. And so, for example, I work with the New York Times, and they have always been very, very good to me and have always looked after not only me, but the people working with me. And so I think that that is fundamental for me.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with Lindsay Addario, Ashley Gilbertson, our wartime photographers. And we'll ask them when we get back, is it more dangerous today than it was maybe 10, 15 years ago? And I think the answer to that question is yes. Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Later on this hour, we'll talk about how Kansas City and Uber finally came to an agreement. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Well, for this segment of the show, we're visiting with two terrific, highly decorated wartime photographers, Lindsay Addario, author of It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. Ashley Gilbertson is also with us. He speaks at 6 p.m. Thursday evening at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. He'll be presenting his series, Bedrooms of the Fallen, photographs of bedrooms of folks who have been killed and died in conflicts around the world. Very moving collection of photographs that connect people with these individuals who have died in a very powerful way. You know, I'm wondering, you know, Ashley, is it more dangerous today to be a wartime photographer? Because I think Lindsay has said that you guys have become commodities to trade by different terrorist groups around the world. Tell me about that, Ashley.
My experience is not as recent as Lindsay's, so I think Lindsay's probably better to field this question. But I know that we have certainly become much more valuable as, you know, kidnap targets. And that was taking place, you know, early on in Iraq, where we could, you know, we could move around early on during the conflict. But then, you know, in the first, you know, I think the first year that passed, we quickly became targets, you know, where it wasn't just the American troops that the insurgents were fighting against. It was very much journalists were worthy of being kidnapped and beheaded on online videos as part of a campaign. And that's become much more commonplace, unfortunately. So, I mean, I would be, I have to say, deathly afraid of what Lindsay is doing. She's got far more streetwise and courage than I do doing this. Because it looks far more dangerous than it ever has for journalists today.
Lindsay, you become a commodity to trade. What does that mean?
Look, I think any journalist right now who works in the Middle East and who works in the countries where there is kidnap, and like Syria, like all the countries bordering Syria, in many countries where there's ISIS, Al-Qaeda, journalists have become a target in a way that we certainly were not when I started out 15 years ago. There used to be a real respect for journalists and journalism. We were considered a neutral observer, and we served a purpose. We had we would go into conflicts and be respected for the work we did. And that doesn't really exist anymore in much of the world. I think there are few countries where I can work now that I feel comfortable going around and having my cameras out and just shooting on the streets.
You know, Lindsay, you begin your book, It's What I Do, with the story of being captured in Libya. And you write that you had a bad feeling about being there at that time, but you couldn't get away. You wound up being held for a week. How challenging of a time was that for you as you went through all that?
How challenging was it during the captivity,
yes,
or leading
exactly
up to the captivity?
Well, both. And even the moment when you think you're going to be okay, and you're driving down the road and you see a group of soldiers up ahead. You don't know who they are exactly, and you know you're maybe the first one in the car who begins to understand your gig is up.
Well, I think I, for whatever reason, I had a premonition. I think that I was, I had been working on the front line for about two straight weeks, and that in and of itself is nerve-wracking, and so I was on edge, and I was exhausted, and I just felt like we knew the front line was moving in that day, and it was moving very quickly, and so for me, I had to, you know, I was in a group, I was in a car full of other journalists, other colleagues, and so in that situation, we are negotiating amongst us how long we want to stay. And so, you know, I think it's a very difficult negotiation to make because there are four of us and we all have different we all have different needs. But I think the captivity itself, for me, I was really in survival mode. So it was just about getting through each moment. And I was really grateful that they kept me with my colleagues and they didn't separate us, because I think that gave me a huge amount of strength that I would not have had I been separated from
them. But in the moments leading up to your capture, as you were being captured, you thought you were about to die. In fact, you thought that any number of times in those key moments there. What was going on?
Well, I mean, you never know. When you are driving towards a hostile checkpoint, you have no idea if you're going to survive. I mean, you know that you are about to drive directly into armed gunmen and that the adrenaline will be racing and that it will be very violent. So you're really at their mercy and how they want to deal with you. And so for me, I always sort of go into an incredibly submissive mode, like, please don't kill me. I mean, I'm begging for my life. So I think that each one of us, very fortunately, each one of us did not, we all were very sort of docile in the sense that we didn't try to fight back. We didn't try and scream and shout and say, you know, don't kill us. We all just did exactly what we were told to do. And I think that that worked to our benefit.
Ashley, you had been shooting war for a few years when you found yourself in Fallujah, and you told NPR that for the first time you came to understand what war is. So I'm wondering, what is it, and what brought you to that insight?
Well, I think I realized in Fallujah, I was embedded with the 18 Bravo unit in what was the most sustained and violent combat the Americans had been involved in since the Vietnam War, since the Battle for Hue. And I was with a lead unit. And I think I realized during that week that I was with them, you know, they lost 12 guys out of the 160. Another 40 guys were wounded. And when I say wounded, I mean, like, they lost their arms or legs or part of their faces and jaws. So I realized that those guys weren't fighting, you know, the enemy or the bad guys necessarily. They were fighting very much for the guys on their left and right. Like, they weren't the guys that I was working with and photographing, the Marines, weren't following like this foreign policy idea that was coming out of Washington and Baghdad. It was very much, it was very immediate. It was very much in the moment. It was very much about, you know, their friends that they were next to, you know, so it wasn't this idea that we're going out to kill bad guys. And it was very much like, we're here to stay alive. And it's the first man down. Like one of these guys is going to die. I think that became really clear, specifically, you know, and it almost never happens that you have a realization like this and then you can find a photograph that, replicates that feeling. But it was during that campaign after a week that they captured an insurgent, and they had him strip his shirt off to make sure he wasn't wearing a suicide vest, and he'd been shot by the Marines already. And he came into this Marine, into this house that was being occupied by the Marines. And they guarded him as a vehicle came to get him medical attention and then have him detained. And I photographed this guy with his head covered and the silhouette, or the actual shadow of a Marine over him. And it was this face, you know, this photograph in which both parties were faceless, that I think really humanized the lack of humanity involved in war. Like, if I know that I was fighting, you know, Lance Corporal William Miller, whose parents, you know, Susie Miller from Pearland, Texas, loved him dearly, it'd be very, very hard for me to pull the trigger. Whereas, and I think it's the same for the Americans fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan back then, that it can't be humanized. And our job as photographers is to humanize this. And I think that's one of the most important drives of what we do as photojournalists every day, is to put a human face on what is happening and to make it vitally critical, you know, that we don't pick up guns and try to kill each other.
Mm-hmm. You know, Cynthia Haynes, one of our movie critics, called to ask Lindsay if there's a movie in the works about her life or maybe even based on your book, Lindsay.
Oh, well, yes.
Really?
Warner Brothers has optioned the rights of my book. So that's sort of as much as I can say. There are people who have expressed interest, but it is a long way off as the screenplay hasn't been written yet. So it will be some time before the film goes into production. But Warner has optioned the rights.
Well, who would you like to play Lindsay Addario in this movie?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm sure whoever Warner and the producers decide would, I'm sure they'd make a great decision.
Yeah. Well, yeah. All of this is kind of exciting, though, isn't it?
It is very exciting. I mean, it's exciting in the sense that, you know, Ashley and I have spent most of our lives documenting issues that we feel are very important and trying to bring light to these issues and trying to personalize them and really bring them home to people. And I think that if a movie would be made in Hollywood that could also do that and can bring the issues we care about to light, then that only helps our cause. I mean, I think it just gives more information to the greater public about what we do and the issues we cover.
Hmm. Ashley, I wanted to ask you about the photo that you have said really made your career, which was a photo of a soldier sliding down the stair banister in Saddam Hussein's palace. And it showed this playful enthusiasm of American soldiers during the war. You've explained this photograph many times, but I would still want to know what photo you've taken that you felt deserved this sort of attention, but maybe didn't get it.
Oh, that's a good question. I think any one of the bedrooms, to be quite honest. I mean, like the sliding down the banister picture of the soldier, it was the last, I think Lindsay, you were there with me. It was in Tikrit, on the day that Tikrit
fell. Oh, yeah.
Right. So there were like all these photographers running around. And there was still combat taking place. You know, so like we'd turn up somewhere and like there'd be 40 Marines about to go into a house and like 12 photographers across the street like photographing it. And I was like, what am I doing? Like, I feel like such a like third wheel. So, I just went to the palace and started like doing tourism and like some guy wearing a military uniform, like totally overweight, his shirt was hanging out, comes up and he's like, you can't talk to Marines. You're not embedded. I'm like, okay, who are you? And he's like, I'm with the LA Times. I'm like, screw you, man. Like, this is really good. So I just like went around with these soldiers and like talked to them. And one of them slid down the banister. I sent it back to my photo agency. It was like a joke. Like, look at this funny thing that I saw. Like, isn't it fun? Turns out it ran like Double Truck in Time magazine, and then the Europeans loved it. Like Time magazine loved it because it showed like the victorious end of the war, and like we finished and we did it. And then the Europeans loved it because it showed the naivete with which the Americans went into Iraq. And like I just sent this picture as like literally a postcard. It was bizarre, but I think that the pictures that I would like people to spend more time with, honestly, and like you know they're out there, so they're easy to find online. They're easy to find in the book is the bedrooms, and I'm the first one to admit. Like, as the author of this book, it is the hardest work that I've ever done. Like, it's the saddest, it's the hardest. There's no, here's the positive message of what I learned from this book. It's tragic. It's so sad. Except I think that we, as a public, have a responsibility to look at these bedrooms and to learn about these young men and women who went off to fight and who died. Not in a sense of patriotism, not in a sense of you know, right or wrong or left or right. You know, I think that we need to look at these images and realize that when we decide as a nation to go to war, that this is the cost that we pay. It's not a question of gold, it's a question of lives.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I don't feel like we in a democracy in America are acting democratically in taking responsibility for what we did. And I don't care if you voted for Bush or if you voted for Gore. It doesn't matter. You know, Romney or Obama. To me, it's We have to connect with who these people are and stop ignoring it. Like the people that I photographed in the bedrooms, Brandon Craig's parents. Brandon's bedroom is actually on the cover. His mother told me that they had lost friends since Brandon died because all of their friends would come over or they would see them, you know, in town, and their friends would talk about anything but Brandon.
Mm.
Don't talk about the dead kid.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas all the parents wanted to talk about was their son.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to talk about like what his body looked like after it had been hit by a roadside bomb. They wanted to talk about the day he covered himself in cicadas when he was 13 years old and everybody was laughing at the town, at the town square. Like, they wanted to share happy memories, but everybody else was too scared.
Hmm.
These families have been ghettoized by us, and it's our responsibility to pay attention and to collectively mourn and acknowledge these losses.
You know, actually, real quickly, there's one photograph in one bedroom. I'm trying to recall who it was, where there's a photograph of Osama bin Laden sort of peering over something else in that's blocking that picture, but all you see are the eyes of Osama bin Laden looking into the room, and there's a Tyra Banks poster just across the room there. But boy, I just thought that was fascinating.
I love it's actually one of my favorite photographs in the book, and I love I see his family really often. It's the bedroom of I was going to say Tommy Gilbert. It's not Tommy Gilbert. It's oh my God, sorry. He's from East North Port, Long Island. And yeah, like that room was absolutely filled with every single thing that he had collected as a child growing up, like shot glasses, T-shirts, newspaper clippings, like everything you could imagine, like the American flags, the roof, the walls, the bed. It was all covered in things. And he apparently called from Karma outside Fallujah before he died. He was killed by a sniper. And he spoke to his family and he said, how are things? And they said, it's pretty good. Your dad's been offered a job down south. So we're thinking about packing up the house and moving. And he said, okay, that sounds cool, but I want you to get a chainsaw and cut my bedroom out and bring it with you, please.
You know, Akers called to ask this, Lindsay, what kind of cameras do you use?
I shoot with Nikon, so I'm constantly updating my cameras, but I've been shooting with Nikon my whole life, and I recently became a Nikon ambassador,
There you go. Yeah. And Lindsay, Joey tweeted this question, Photo Voice is employed to empower communities. Do you suspect the photos would be different if you gave families the camera?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important for people to photograph in their own communities as well. I'm constantly sort of parachuting into places and trying to document what people's lives are like in these very intimate moments. But I would love for people to be able to photograph their own communities.
And that would be powerful. Why, in your view?
Because I think that people from within a family and within a culture have an access and an understanding that we as outsiders don't always have. And so I do think, and they're there 24 hours a day, whereas we are not. We as outsiders have to work very hard to gain the trust of people. We have to come in and out of situations. I always try and go back many, many times and to one family or to one place to try and get the most accurate view. But I really think at the end of the day, people from within a culture often have the best access.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I want to thank our wartime photographers for their time today. What an interesting conversation. Lindsay Addario, author again of It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. And look for her on the silver screen at some point down the road here, perhaps. Lindsay, what a pleasure to have you. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having us. Thanks.
Ashley Gilbertson's also been with us. He speaks at the Nelson Atkins Auditorium at 6 o'clock Thursday evening to present the photo series Bedrooms of the Fallen. Ashley, what a pleasure. Good luck to you, and please travel safe out there.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.